Hello, welcome to Mosaics, a podcast by the Idaho Office for Refugees. I'm your host, Holly Beach, and today I am really honored to be here with a guest with a national perspective on what's going on right now with resettlement and immigration. So please join me in welcoming John Slocum. John is the Executive Director of Refugee Council USA, which are wonderful partners. They do great work on the national scale. He's got quite an impressive, rich resume. I'm not going to read every bullet point here for you today, but John has done a lot of great work in consulting and strategic planning around migration and refugees and human rights. He's lived and done work in Russia. He's worked with the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation in areas of grant-making initiatives, including things like global migration and U.S. immigration policies. So, John, we're really honored to have you here and to learn from your perspective. Welcome to Mosaics.
Thank you so much, Holly. It's great to be with you.
Before we dive into any of the topics, I want people to have a chance to get to know you as John. So tell us a little bit about you, your background, where you grew up, things like that.
Sure. Happy to do so. And begin by saying I'm a Midwesterner. I grew up in Central Illinois. I got an undergraduate degree in political science from University of Illinois and a PhD from the University of Chicago. I have lived in or near Chicago for most of my adult life with a few sojourns elsewhere. And after teaching for a few years at the University of Oklahoma, I went to work for the MacArthur Foundation, which is in Chicago, and did some grant making in Russia. Many trips there supporting human rights groups, environmental groups, and independent universities and think tanks in the late 90s and the 2000s, which was very exciting. And during that time, I gradually transitioned to work on global migration, and I directed some migration initiatives, as you mentioned, on a global scale. About how migration is governed globally, both within and adjacent to the United Nations system. And then some work on U.S. immigration policy, basically funding policy research, and work on what we called the migration corridor of Central America, Mexico, and U.S., and that mostly focused on labor migration. Okay. So I had a good background on those topics. And then worked as a consultant for a few years and came to Refugee Council USA first as a board member, then as an interim, and then permanent executive director. And I've been in that role for about 4.5 years now.
And can you briefly explain what Refugee Council USA is?
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, Refugee Council USA, or RCUSA, is a national umbrella association of nonprofits that advocate for and serve refugees and other forcibly displaced people. We actually were founded 25 years ago as an informal collective. Over the years, it's been formalized. In the time I've served as executive director, our membership has increased by 60%. We now have 42 members. They include the national resettlement agencies and a host of other organizations, large and small. And we serve as a coordination platform for advocacy, communications, and resettlement operations on the national level. And in addition, we operate some special projects that are aimed at supporting refugee leadership.
That's great. I know I have benefited from the webinars, from the explainers. So thank you for the work that you do. It helps us here on the local level to have a better understanding of what's going on. So thank you.
Sure.
I'm curious if you could share more about what drew you to work in this field of migration and human rights, and if you have any, you know, stories from your childhood that may have influenced you, or things from your family that drew you to this work.
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer sort of partly from a kind of an academic perspective, but I do want to talk about the family links as well. I mean, the work that I studied in graduate school in particular was on nationalism. I wrote a dissertation on nationality politics in late imperial Russia. So I knew a bit about how the Russian state sort of grappled with, prior to the Soviet period, the fact that they were a multinational, multi-ethnic empire. And I think somehow that work remains relevant to the much more practical and applied work that I've been doing more recently. The motivations, I think, for anyone who stays with a field of work for any length of time are really more personal. And for me, I come from a family that is not new, you know, to the United States. My father's side, it goes back to the 1600s. Mm-hmm. But and I guess that distinguishes me from, you know, a lot of people that do work in the immigration field. So how do I get the personal connection? You know, it's a couple things. And I want to mention here my mother, who passed away at a relatively young age, but was very, whatever the opposite of xenophilic. she was trained as a teacher of English as a second language, or I think they called it English for foreign students at that time. And this is about 70 years ago. And before having kids, she taught for a short period of time, actually more than I imagined, because just a couple of years ago, I came across her grade book in a box that had been stored away in my basement. And this is classes she taught at the University of Illinois in the mid-1950s. Wow. And it was really magical to hold this artifact in my hands. And a couple of things jumped out at me. One is that she was a really tough grader. And probably, you know, there's been a lot of grade inflation in the last 70 years. But the other thing is just the multitude of names, the variety of names in that book. Obviously, there were students from Latin America, from Africa, from Asia, from Europe, and just a little United Nations in the pages of that book. And that gave me kind of a renewed sense of where I'd come from, right? And where this interest, you know, in people from other parts of the world may have, you know, the seeds may have been planted for me. And so I really feel, you know, a strong emotional connection to the fact that in some respects, I feel like I'm carrying on my mother's work.
It's so beautiful that you were able to have that still. I know you were a kid when she passed away. And so to have that continued connection with her and her passion is so cool. I'm glad that that book was saved and preserved for you to find.
Me too. Thank you. Yeah.
I think, you know, something top of mind right now, you mentioned you're in Chicago, and all of us here around the country are seeing videos, stories, really heart-wrenching things going on. I want to hear how you're doing. Like, what's the situation like for you and for people you're serving and working with?
Yeah. Well, you know, to say a couple of things up front, what's happening is not, you know, directly impacting me or my family. It may be impacting my neighbors, some of whom are either born outside the United States or have family members who were. I think it's affecting us all as a country, but very specifically here to Chicago, to your point, to your question, where I live is about a one city block outside Chicago city limits. 6 miles due west of me is Broadview, where the ICE facility is located. And, you know, at the time we're taping this, we're several weeks into very intense scenes of protest, of very militarized ICE and CBP activity, not only at this Broadview facility, which is in many respects a focal point, but in and around the entire Chicago area. And I have to say, I haven't been to Broadview. I haven't personally witnessed ICE activity, although I live maybe 4 blocks away from the village hall of our suburb. And there was ICE there one day, I was told. But we do hear more helicopters overhead. Mm-hmm. And some of them are traffic copters because we're next to an expressway. It's Chicago, after all. But the things in the city are very tense, and we do feel a bit under siege. And it's an uncomfortable feeling to have that level of militarized immigration enforcement in our backyard, you know, almost literally. And so lots of friends from around the Chicago area are speaking out, are involved in volunteer activities of one kind or another. And it's just, I hope folks have seen, you know, some of the reports. There was a very, I would say, infamous incident in late September where in the Chicago neighborhood of South Shore, there were some 300, I think they were CBP, Customs and Border Patrol forces that descended, some of them literally in a helicopter, from a helicopter onto an apartment building. And I can't remember if it's 300 forces or 300 people in the apartment building, but nonetheless, there's a lot of troop activity. And they basically took everyone out of the apartment building. They say zip tied them. They segregated by race into different vans and that sort of thing. And it's just, I just have to ask the question, how on earth did we get to this point, you know, where we have that level of militarized immigration enforcement? I don't think it's about immigration policy on some level. I don't think it's about public safety, because people feel much less secure knowing that they're, you know, their friends, neighbors, maybe, you know, the tamale seller on the corner. That's a real example for a neighbor of mine or a friend of mine from the north side of Chicago, or, you know, members of their congregation or parents from the school. I have a neighbor who teaches school near Broadview, and one of their parents was taken away, leaving the kids. And there are other ways of approaching all of those problems. I could go on and on about this. I feel very passionately about it as a de facto Chicagoan, but it's really unfair the way our city's been portrayed. It's not a city that's without its difficulties like any city. But this is not what anyone here is asking for. And it's a very heavy feeling being here now.
I think you're right when you said the heaviness is felt across the country. You know, what we see, what we picture America to be, and that's not having our own military on our streets. That's just not something that you think of when you think of America, in my mind, or having little kids or moms or people having their dog be shot by agents after warning them, hey, I'm going to put my dog in the bathroom. Like, that really got to me too, as an owner of dogs, and thinking of that happening. Like, if that were to, you do everything you can to protect, they can't protect themselves, and to have that kind of violation. This is not what you think of when you think of America, I think. It's heavy, I think, for the whole country to see how people are being. And obviously, it's not new that our country has had immigration raids. It's been going on for forever. But it does seem like there's more indiscrimination right now about how it's being carried out. I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, in, you know, what's changed and what hasn't, you had actually directed my attention to a recent Throughline podcast about the evolution of ICE over the years and its origins going back to the 1980s and 1990s. And it's true. You know, probably from the founding of this country, immigration has been an issue of political contention, and that flares up at times. And I think one of the things that happened in the 80s and 90s is we began to reach a level of immigration and immigrants as a percentage of the population, non-native born people as a percentage of the population, that we had not seen for 40 years or more, you know, from the time of, you know, when immigration restrictions kicked in the 1920s until the 1960s, when it began to open up more. And I just think that demographic shift became sort of, for a lot of people, a disruption of their assumptions about what the United States was about. And then I think here and worldwide, it's the easiest thing on earth to blame immigrants for your problems. You know, it's almost, except for the human cost of the consequences of doing so, it's almost cost-free for politicians who can operate almost fact-free by making arguments by anecdote and putting out misinformation or disinformation about what's happening. So perceptions have galloped ahead of reality, and many times intentionally, you know, stoked by politicians. And then, you know, we've had major turning points like 9/11, which I think put a crack in the solidarity that we'd had on a bipartisan basis for immigration. But even then, we had several attempts that came very close to comprehensive immigration reform on a bipartisan basis nationally, most recently in 2013, which did not cross the finish line. But then you get some new waves of migration, particularly, you know, Syrians and others, you know, post and, you know, escaping conflict in the teens. And that led to the current cycle. And it's just unfortunate because I think as recently as 2013, you could find bipartisan consensus on the value of immigrants. And I think that's fundamentally the problem, that we've been so drawn into a threat image on immigrants and immigration that we've lost track of the sight that, you know, in the big picture, immigration is a net asset. Immigrants provide an opportunity, and there are costs which need to be managed. But I don't think we're having an honest conversation about immigration policy anymore. I think we've gone well beyond that, and the result is we get this very, I think, a toxic rhetoric and extremist enforcement activity.
Yeah, you've written about the values of immigration and refugee resettlement. What do you see those, like, the top ones being for a country?
Well, I think, you know, I think the United States, when it comes to its the way it was populated, you know, there are some, there's a lot of tragedy for some of those who, you know, who were brought here, you know, enslaved. There is a lingering tragedy when it comes to the initial inhabitants of this continent.
Yeah.
And I think we work through those and we've never completely resolved them. But as subsequent waves of people have come here, I think they've found, you know, freedom, opportunity, and paths to self-expression and success that they might not have been able to find anywhere else on Earth. Certainly that's been the case, you know, with persons that have been persecuted for their religious beliefs, those that have suffered from racial discrimination, ethnic conflict, you know, and others, and those who come simply seeking economic opportunity. So to miss how enriching that has been, to have folks who had the gumption and wherewithal to get up and go and start new lives in our country, I think has been an enriching factor from the outset. I mean, there's all kinds of sort of cliched ways of talking about that. But something that I like to point to is a study group that I was involved with as a funder when I worked for the MacArthur Foundation. This was about 12 years ago. And there was the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which is a highly respected civic institution here in Chicago, put together a task force. They called it the Midwest Immigration Task Force. And they released a study, again, right around 2013, this inflection point I'm talking about, that was titled U.S. Economic Competitiveness at Risk. And this was a bipartisan group, former governors, former mayors, current mayors, business leaders, and so forth from around the greater 12-state Midwest, so including the Dakotas and Illinois and its surrounding states and so forth. And their conclusion was that, you know, if you look at small town America and big cities, immigration has just been a vital engine of economic growth and competitiveness, right? And what stood out for me from that report and what I quoted in something that I wrote here for the Chicago Sun-Times a couple of months ago is that I was pretty close to the folks who were running that task force. So this task force insisted, and there is a chapter in their report that they talk about the moral case for immigration. And it's about respecting human dignity. It's about not treating immigrants as just factors of production. They come here, you know, just to do work.
Yeah, cheap labor.
They come here to lead lives, right? Mm-hmm. And I do firmly believe that we've just gotten in a lazy habit of blaming immigrants for problems that are not of their making. Mm-hmm. And politicians make a lot of hay with that.
I want to chat too about refugee resettlement in particular, my line of work. We are seeing reports that the year ahead, U.S. is only going to welcome 7,500 refugees. That hasn't been confirmed yet, but that's what we're expecting. And we are expecting a lot of those positions not to go to the folks that were already in the pipeline and approved, but to actually be dedicated toward Afrikaners from South Africa. So that's what we're expecting now, and we're waiting for official word. You know, can you speak to the ways that local communities are going to be impacted by this? The rhetoric around this policy decision, what's important for people to know?
Yeah, I want to preface it by saying, although I'm, you know, have a perch from which we're talking about national policy, I think everyone who does that kind of work knows that the real welcoming is done at the local level, right? So it's, if anything, we have more to learn from service providers. And I've actually never worked, you know, as a direct service provider than the other way around. And from what we know, well, first of all, just as in some many other lines of work, you know, related to human services, so many people have seen their life's work that have, you know, dedicated themselves in service of refugees, have seen that life's work challenged. And many folks, you know, I don't have to tell you, are, you know, no longer able to work in that field because it's been so, the refugee program has essentially been suspended since late January with just a very small number of refugee entrants since then. And what we also know is that it's not just the work of people whose, you know, jobs, their paid positions are to work for a local refugee serving agency. It's a community-wide thing. And it is the congregations that mobilize and provide volunteer hours. It's increasingly in recent years, it's private sponsors and those who've signed up to privately sponsor refugees. So there's tens, probably hundreds of thousands of those folks across the country who are prepared to, you know, welcome the stranger in ways that now they're being told, no, thank you, we don't need your services. And it's refugees already here whose family members they've been waiting to be able to be reunited with, that they're not going to have that opportunity. And to limit refugee resettlement to this small of a population and this particular population, it's a real slap in the face, I think, to welcomers at the local level who won't get their communities enriched and won't be able to do this service and will miss out on the friendships and the wonderful relationships that, you know, will emerge. We'll miss out on the job starts, on the entrepreneurialism that refugees bring. And I understand that the numbers have waxed and waned over the decades that we've had a resettlement program. I understand that the refugees we welcome, there's always been some, perhaps, political thumb on the scale here and there. But right now is just so out of line with what, you know, if these reports are true about 7,500 and the vast majority of them being Afrikaners, it's so out of whack with what this program's been about.
Yeah, you mentioned the private sponsors, and many of them themselves were the family members. They're like, oh, we finally found a pathway, you know, to reunite with my sister before, you know, mom's memory gets worse, or to be with my child before I miss too many more birthdays. They finally, I met so many of these families, and oof, that's the part to me of like, you had that light at the end of the tunnel, and you had the email confirming, yes, after all these years, after all the applications you've gone through, every hoop you had to jump through, here's a ticket and here's a flight date. That's, and I just, since January, that's been breaking my heart every day. And like you said, not personally, it's not my family, but it's very real in our community and the people I work with and the people I care about. And I thought, I didn't know that the end in sight would be, you know, this long to get there, but especially for them, because they've already been waiting so long in unsafe situations, especially some of these family members that have people in Afghanistan or getting sent back to Afghanistan from neighboring countries. It's just, that's been very hard. And I see this program, the Refugee Resettlement Program, you know, it's like, I see it as one of the most efficient, streamlined, well-run pieces of the immigration system. I mean, it's, you know, people are vetted and checked very thoroughly, and they have support systems when they arrive so they can get on their feet. And then they do go on to contribute so much more. So it just seems to make sense to me, especially as a country that wants to be, you know, live up to our values. It makes sense that that's a way to do so.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's still very strong public support for refugee resettlement. In fact, there's some recent polling that indicates that there's greater support this year in 25 than there was in 2024.
Yeah, I saw that. That was cool.
And it's bipartisan support. So, you know, if you say you want people to, you know, come here legally, here you go. Here's a program that's been bringing here people here legally for 45 years. Now, that's not to say that, you know, anyone who doesn't come in through refugee resettlement isn't also, you know, worthy of, you know, respect for their human dignity and human rights. Yeah. But it is, it's a program that, you know, there's been a lot of evolution in the program. There's been a lot of innovation pointing the way toward, I think, a future that's going to be, you know, an even better program than the one we knew in the past. But you know, to invoke the kind of discriminatory refugee policy that is going to leave, as you point out, you know, just the numbers are staggering. It's over 200,000 people in the pipeline to come to the United States. 123,000, I think, is the figure for those who've already essentially been cleared by USCIS. They've been vetted. 14,000 or so had their plane tickets in hand. They were cleared to travel when the program was suspended. And as you know, there's a lawsuit that's been grinding its way through the courts to try to unfreeze that. There's a travel ban that affects many of the countries from which, you know, that are refugee sending countries or countries of origin for refugees. So there's all these doors are being slammed shut.
Yeah. And it's definitely a local thing, like you said. These are national political decisions and rhetoric that we're hearing and seeing, but it's, at the end of the day, it's a local issue. What, you know, you have mentioned that, and I will say as we record this, it's October 17th. So if you're listening later and anything's changed, I apologize. Things are changing week to week, but that's where we are today as we talk. I want to hear more about, you said in your column, I really enjoyed your Chicago Sun-Times column in July. You said we must move away from the shock and awe of the last few months and toward an immigration system that reflects the best of America. What do you think that best of America looks like? What do you think that is?
Well, I think it's it's one where we recognize that it's not in our self-interest to be selfish, full stop. And there's a sense that we can sort of draw in the ladder and survive and thrive, you know, without the participation of people from other, you know, that were born in other countries in what we do. And I just think that's a fundamentally mistaken view of what it is to be a human being in the world. You know, we have national borders. We have those boundaries, and they're there for a reason. And yet, human mobility has been a, you know, long time, ancient fact of life, and it's how we progress. People bring ideas. They engage in trade. And I guess in that sense, yeah, I'm an internationalist. But I think I mentioned selfishness because I do think that there's a way in which the way that our economy has evolved, the way technology has evolved, it unfortunately can lead to a reinforcement of hyper-individualism in ways that, you know, appear to be sort of libertarian and positive, but then lead to this kind of very ugly and certainly not libertarian outcomes of having, you know, armed troops in the streets chasing down anyone who, you know, whose skin color suggests they may not be native born, which is, you know, a thoroughly racist and unlawful policy. And so I think being welcoming is tough in a land of individualists. I mean, we do that within the bounds of our own communities, but it's time to remember that our community is not just the very small unit of folks that, you know, look and think most like us, and that we're all intertwined in a much broader set of relationships that extend around the world. There's a member organization of RCUSA called Welcoming America, which really takes this on and you know, has this program of certified welcoming communities. And it's not just about immigrants. It's about so everyone feels a sense of belonging. And I think that's what we need to bring back, is that sense of belonging, but without doing it in an exclusionary way.
Yeah.
Right, which is what some folks would have us do. I think we'll stagnate and decline as a country the more we go in that direction.
I think what we want to see is human dignity and the ability to live without fear, go to school without fear, and to not have where you were born define if you're worthy of a certain level of human rights and dignity. And so that's, I am encouraged to see people continuing to speak out, to support us, you know, reaching out to the Idaho Office of Refugees or our agency partners and donating coats and buying a gala ticket so they can raise money and giving people rides to English class. Like, these are the little things that we're seeing and just remind me so much. You know, I was talking to someone who's a former refugee, now works in resettlement. And she's like, you know, I started to feel really dizzy and my coworker drove me to the ER, and then I came home and they've been just checking in on me, making sure I have food and everything I needed. I'm like, yeah, see, that's, people are still humans. We still care. And that's what I try to always focus on when the national stuff that's on my Instagram reels just feels a little too much. I don't want to turn away from it. I know it's happening.
Right.
But there's a lot of love to go around, I think, especially when we, on the local level, we have folks that are, you know, scheduling, not our folks, but like partners in the community, that they'll schedule a meeting with a congressional staffer and just talk about how their refugee friends mean so much to them and they are so happy that they're here in, you know, they're teaching in the schools and that kind of thing. So I think if you're like me out there, listeners, this can get overwhelming and it can be hard not to want to just, if you have the luxury to turn away, it can be hard not to want to just do that. But this is, you know, this is a big time in our country. Who are we? Who do we want to be? And I think, I know a lot of us want to still be welcoming, and not that we're going to save everyone or, you know, but just what we can, these programs that exist and have existed for decades and been working well, you know, some of them.
I agree completely. It's easy to get caught up in the social media world and being face to face and helping each other is ultimately what's going to get us there. And I think helping newcomers helps jolt us out of routine in a way which is just a tiny taste of the degree to which they've been jolted.
Yeah.
Right. But many of them, and I was listening to some of the podcasts in your series, you know, many of the people that come to the United States come from countries where the thickness of social connection is much stronger than it is for many of us in the United States. And they can remind us of what it's like to be caring for someone, you know, outside your immediate family, outside your immediate neighborhood congregation. It's again, I don't want to be trite or, you know, hackneyed about it, but it really is teaching you, reminding you of some fundamentals that sometimes it's easy to get distracted and lose sight of.
Yeah, for sure. It's a reminding point for me all the time. And I'm not always the best at living that out. You know, I am a subject of this individualistic culture and I realize that, but it is, those relationships have really helped challenge me and help me grow. So I'm very grateful for them. And for you, John, for coming and chatting with us. I know there could be so much that we could cover. I want to make sure that we, you know, touch on things that are important to you. Is there anything else that you would like to discuss?
Well, I mean, one thing that weighs on me, and not just on me, but a lot of folks that are, you know, working on national policy, is that, you know, the United States has an extraordinarily large footprint in the world. And what we do here resonates and finds reflection elsewhere. And we have historically been, you know, the leader in providing humanitarian assistance, in welcoming refugees and so forth. But when we cut that off, I mean, cutting off humanitarian assistance is so counterproductive in the long run, not only for the lives that it affects, but for the you know, the knock-on effect of not addressing poverty and violence and disease in other parts of the world, right? But when it comes to refugee resettlement, if essentially leave the scene, I forget the exact percentage, but it's an extraordinarily, you know, large percentage of the total number of folks to be resettled around the world who won't get that opportunity. And other countries are likely to follow suit.
Yeah, you know? I think Germany did earlier this year as well. Posits program. Yeah. I'm not sure where that stands, but it's a signal that, yeah, it's kind of a domino effect.
Yeah. And it's not all about what the U.S. does. I mean, there's economic and technological, you know, trends everywhere that affect things in similar ways. But, you know, the voice of the United States and its actions do sort of loom large in the world. And frankly, in some ways now, I think there are other countries who are going to have to just pick up the slack and you know, maybe look for moral leadership on some of these humanitarian issues elsewhere if it's not going to be furnished. But one good thing about the United States is that it's not all about the government, right? It's the strength of civil society from the local level to the national level that I think will carry on and will do its part, you know, even if there's, you know, national policies that have become, you know, counter to the welcoming spirit, that's not going to die out among the American people.
I agree with you. And I think so many of us have recent family in our history that had to be welcomed as well. And so
on my side of the family, but my wife's grandparents, her maternal grandparents fled from, you know, Nazi-controlled Germany and Austria as, you know, Jewish refugees in the late 1930s.
Yeah.
So it's not that far away.
Yep. Well, John Slocum, Executive Director of Refugee Council USA, it has been an honor to talk with you. I have enjoyed reading what you've written in the past few months. Thank you for helping offer that insight and perspective. It's been really useful for me. Thanks for all you do. And we appreciate you coming on Mosaics.
Thank you, Holly. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining the conversation. For more information on how to be involved with refugee resettlement, please visit idahorefugees.org. Mosaics is produced by the Idaho Office for Refugees with grant support from the M.J. Murdoch Charitable Trust. Music by the Afrosonics. Production in partnership with SB Studios.